Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement by Vladimir Putin that he will release his most prominent political prisoner, as well as two of the members of the punk rock group Pussy Riot. Nina Kusheva, a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School, joins us to discuss Putin's apparent confidence that he can appear magnanimous, having got his way in Syria, Ukraine, and at home, where he has eradicated all opposition and extinguished politics in Russia ahead of hosting his showcase Winter Olympic Games in Sochi. Then we'll speak with Lako Tongan, who is a professor of international and intercultural studies and political studies at Pitzer College. He is from South Sudan, and we'll discuss the leadership struggle between President Salva Kiir and his former vice president, Riek Machar, that threatens to break out into a civil war as army mutineers take a key town. We'll get an analysis of the reasons behind the fratricide in the world's newest country and one of its poorest, that has been at war with its northern neighbor and now appears poised to go to war against itself. Then finally, we will speak with Wallace Turberville, who is a senior fellow at Demos and previously an investment banker at Goldman Sachs, who has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate and the House Financial Services Committee. He is the author of a new report at Demos, The Detroit Bankruptcy, and we will discuss this unnecessary bankruptcy imposed on the Democratic City by a partisan Republican governor, and the latest ruling by the federal bankruptcy judge criticizing the priority of paying back Wall Street banks 82 cents on the dollar while offering police, fire, and city pensioners 16 cents on the dollar. And joining us now is Nina Kusheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. She is currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Kusheva.
Thank you.
And it does appear after President Putin's press conference on Thursday, where at the end of it he made a kind of offhand remark that he was freeing the oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky, that caught everybody by surprise. Are you surprised by that move?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I would have said he probably wouldn't pardon him, because until very recently there was all this conversation of how dangerous Khodorkovsky is, and he's short of a murderer, or maybe is, and therefore and a thief, and so he has to be kept in jail. But on the other hand, Putin is really trying to clean up his image for the Sochi Olympics that are coming up in a month or so, and he is trying to present himself as somebody where rights, human rights, are not frustrated, and he does appreciate the benevolent gestures. I mean, of course, the problem with this kind of approach is that it doesn't really make Putin look civilized, but much more of a tradition of first Russian Empire, then Soviet Empire, and now Putin. So I don't think it's that surprising. What is interesting is going to come after that. I mean, what kind of life Khodorkovsky can expect with this kind of Kremlin pardon and high level pardon? Is he going to be a public figure? Will he allow to be a public figure? Would he be forced to immigrate to, say, America or England? I mean, that is a very important question.
So, when Putin is under threat, he is petulant, petty, and vindictive. But he's now behaving in a magnanimous way. He's cut the sentences and freed two of the Pussy Riot women. He seems to be confident in terms of his foreign policy. He seemed to beat out the West in this diplomatic duel over Syria. He's just this week, he got Ukraine out of the deal with the EU, and now he's bought that corrupt government with an economic bailout. And then, of course, he's pushing this idea of his own Eurasian Union with Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, and now Ukraine. So Is this a case of him being confident enough to be magnanimous?
Well, yes, to a degree he is quite magnanimous, because he does take this these instances, and you know, this he shouldn't, but he does. He shouldn't take it as a sign of trust that all these things happen. It's just, you know, certain countries found themselves in dire straits, and so they had to go and use Putin, who was conveniently offering his services. But he does misconstrue it as his, you know, grown influence around the world, and something that he's been arguing for 14 years now, that Russia is a world player. It can dictate the fates of the world on the par with the United States. You mentioned the press conference. I mean, it was interesting that he has been sort of the various talking points of Putin floating around, and he in fact said, well, about the NSA spying and Edward Snowden, he said, well, lucky Barack Obama, he can do things like that, he can spy and there's no consequences. So Putin feels that he's very vindicated, not so much for the efforts of Russia, but for various conditions that various countries in the world found themselves in today. So one would say he's a very lucky leader, because things work out for him somehow. But I wouldn't really, you know, I wouldn't go with Putin to say that this is, that he can rest on his laurels, because the world is changing all the time, and Russia is not, and Putin's Russia is not. And therefore, I don't really envision that this so-called victories, opportunistic victories for Putin, actually can last a long time. Usually this kind of victories are very tactical, they're not strategic in any way, and the time passes and, you know, Putin remains. So I wouldn't, if I were Putin, I wouldn't be taking such a grandstanding. Actually, I would keep working on the improvement of Russia's standing rather than taking advantage of poor other countries' standing.
And again, I'm speaking with Nina Kosheva, who's a professor of in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, let's face it, though. It seems to me that Putin doesn't really have any real plans to advance Russia. He seems to be more obsessed with trying to diminish the United States, and he's basically eradicated all political opposition and essentially completely neutralized the political life of Russia. Is there a political life left in Russia?
Well, you are completely right that he doesn't. I mean, that's exactly what I was saying, is that Putin has very little place to go, because all these things about what not Russia is, but what Russia, how Russia can stick it to other countries. So that is a very good assessment. As for political life, actually, there is a political life. I mean, you know, Russia has experienced the rise of political life in the last couple of years, when first Putin announced that he's going to become president again, which is, would be his third term and 13th year in power. That's first of all. So the opposition got energized, and there were protest movement. I mean, nothing comparing to Ukraine, of course, but still rather large protests against Putin and Putinism that have been going on. So I actually wouldn't say that, I mean, he wants to diminish the political life, but that's the problem, is that the longer he stays, actually the more political life, in fact, Russia will have, because at this point, it is so clear that there is no positive, anything positive that Putin can bring to either political life or economic life or any life in Russia whatsoever.
Well, it is, of course, a resource-based economy, and mostly on oil and gas, and with fracking and other improvements in oil production in the West, the U.S. is rapidly becoming self-sufficient and has surpassed Russia as the world's number one supplier of gas. A part of this bribe to keep Ukraine in the Russian fold has been this $18 billion loan, and plus a discount on Russian gas. What's your sense, though, of how long this oil and gas-based economy is going to last?
Well, that's, I mean, that is exactly the point, how long it's going to last, because Russia is not, that's what I was saying, it's the sort of oldest achievements are tactical, they are not modern in any way. It is a military-industrial complex that is being continuously built, and the world is moving forward, not, I mean, with bouts and setbacks, but still the world is moving forward. And so that is a good question, how long it's going to last. And so far, as I said, Putin has been very lucky. The world has presented him with all these opportunities, but it doesn't stay this way. And the longer he's in power, the harder the world works to move away from oil dependency or military dependency, or even diminish Russia's influence that Putin seems to be riding high at this point. So this is really a very closet way of dealing. I mean, he may think he's riding high on foreign policy, but it's a very closeted approach. It's all about Russia first, and you really, in the 21st century, this is also a very limited approach, because countries like Russia, of 9 time zones, you know, from Germany to Japan, they're very difficult to sustain in a viable or reliable manner. This is not China. This is not the United States. Russia really cannot sustain its size in modern economic environment.
So, Nina Khrushcheva, just going back to the press conference on Thursday, where Putin held forth for, I think, his usual 3 or 4 hours, and at the end of it, he basically, off the cuff, he just said that, by the way, we're going to free Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who spent more than 10 years in prison. That's serious enough punishment, he said. And meanwhile, of course, in this press conference, there was the usual displays of sycophancy from the almost entirely government-controlled press. One of the reporters offered him a little stuffed animal. It's pretty embarrassing as a journalist to watch this kind of stuff. But he's also shut down the Russian news service, has he not, and replaced that essentially with his own public relations operation?
Well, he didn't really shut down the Russian news service. He just changed the direction of it, so to speak. He renamed it from the news service. It's going to be Russia Today or Russia something or other of this kind, and it's going to, he sort of announced that it's going to stand for conservative Russian values and family traditions. So he has been making this argument that he is the center of original Christianity, which once again is such an old argument for the Russian Empire, in fact, because it was always arguing against the decadent West and how Orthodox Christianity stands for traditional and conservative values. And so once again, tactically, it may work for some places that are more conservative than modern European countries, but strategically, once again, where is he going to go with this? This is not a Byzantine Empire anymore. We're in 2013. And so he, in some ways, he thinks he's consolidating Russia and consolidating Russian influence. But more than anything, he's shooting himself in the foot, because it is such an unmodern approach that he proposes, and also incredibly hypocritical, because the man who is going to be in charge of this new Russia Today conservative values news creating set of values, as this man said, has been divorced. Putin himself was very famously divorced last summer. So that is kind of rich coming out of this man, that they are going to promote Christian conservative values. Russia has no place to go unless it reforms itself, restructures itself, loses territory, and rethinks its military-industrial complex altogether.
Well, would that explain then this anti-gay jihad, these two good Christian family men that you just mentioned? I mean, we have here in the United States this hideous homophobic outburst from the Duck Dynasty character, those people all couch themselves in religiosity, and at the same time they, you know, are dripping with bigotry. It would seem to me that, as far as I can tell from Putin's anti-gay jihad, it's popular in Russia, And he's trying to have it both ways with Sochi, saying, you know, that gay athletes aren't going to be persecuted. But Obama has appointed an openly gay head of the U.S. Olympic delegation. So what's your sense of how will there be, do you think, any kind of protests both for and against Putin's homophobia in Sochi?
Well, I'm sure there will be protests, and I would not go as far as, I hate disagreeing with you, but I wouldn't go as far as saying it's anti-gay jihad, because if you look at this law carefully, the way the law is presented, I mean, we can argue how genuine it is, but the way the law is presented, it's against gay propaganda towards the minors, so it's not exactly go and beat up gays. Of course, Russians may understand it this way and do understand it this way in some ways. But Putin himself would argue that that's not what he is looking into. It he's just sort of promoting gay pedophilia and gay way of life to the minors. So he would say that there is no jihad there. And I think we should be careful with this kind of words. This is one thing. But another thing, good for Barack Obama not going, good for many leaders in Europe not going, and Putin shouldn't have expected. It was a good lesson for him because, you know, if he wanted that kind of law be introduced, do it up to the Olympics. I mean, if Russia wants that law introduced. He decided he can do it all. He couldn't do it all. So that's a good lesson for him. As for protests, I'm sure they will happen. I think Putin will be very careful not to beat up the protesters or treat them in any inhumane way, at least while the foreigners are there watching. What happens afterwards, that we'll have to see. How that is going to play out, we'll have to see. But I don't think that Putin can afford, and it seems that he understands it a bit more now, is that he cannot really afford a blatant anti-Western or blatant anti-gay kind of pronouncements against gay propaganda towards minors. And I think that's why he's toning down his conversations about it. I mean, just recently he said, well, he's no problem with any athletes who come to Sochi and whatnot. So I think he slightly understands, I don't know how much he understands because he thinks he's such an emperor, but slightly understands he probably went a bit too far with this kind of law. Not that this law is not going to come back in full force right after the Olympics is over.
Well, one of the aspects of that law, though, I understand, and it's true, it's couched in the idea that somehow gays run around recruiting vulnerable young men and boys, and this has to be stopped. But I understand there's a vigilante component to the law, that people are allowed to take the law into their own hands to stop this perceived activity.
Well, that is, I mean, and that is sort of a problem. So because Putin knows his own country, and even that such an ambiguous law, of course, in the hands of Russians who are homophobic and macho thinking and whatnot, can be and are taken very, very far. But that's generally a problem with any Russian law, is when, you know, the police is told to keep paradox, to keep the order, then the police goes too far. When the guards are told to guard something, they go too far. I mean, and that is kind of a problem. It's just generally a problem with a country that has no laws and always looks for order. So that is sort of a general problem that Russia experiences, is that law is prone to interpretation. Order is not. Order is just one way that everybody is kept in line. And that's where the greatest problem is.
Well, just in the last minute, Nina Khrushcheva, back to the freeing of the oil tycoon, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was in fact perceived by Putin as his main political rival, and he's neutralized him by putting him in jail for 11 years. They were even moving to increase charges against him, and this caused the liberal economist Sergei Guriev to flee Russia for Paris. So Is there any possibility? You were suggesting earlier that perhaps Khodorkovsky will probably leave the country. In other words, there's no he doesn't have a political future there, does he?
Well, I actually that I what I was saying is that it would be really interesting to see what kind of future he has, because I imagine he envisions his political future, because he would join the protests and with his name and his credentials of, you know, being in Gulag, in contemporary Russian Gulag for 11 years, he would be a very attractive opposition figure. The question is how free he's going to continue with that. I mean, wouldn't, you know, if he goes and has some sort of an opposition movement, would he be arrested immediately now for inciting violence against Putin? That is a really important question. The important question is to see how far Khodorkovsky will be allowed to go in his political future, his economic future, his any future. So it is possible that he will choose to leave the country and perhaps run some opposition movement from the outside, because I'm not sure he would have enough freedom to do it inside the country. And the question is how willing he will be to go back to prison this time for, say, I don't know, as I said, inciting violence against
sure.
Putin, or whatever Putin decides to charge him with.
Sure, and of course he's lost most of his money. It's been confiscated. His companies have been confiscated and handed over to Putin's cronies, so he wouldn't have not just his political horizons are limited, his economic horizons have also been limited. I thank you for joining us, Nina Kosheva. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nina Kosheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She is also an editor and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia, Between Art and Politics. She's currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the likelihood of a civil war now in South Sudan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lako Tongan, who is a professor of International and Intercultural Studies and Political Studies at Pitzer College. He was born and raised in what is the world's newest country, South Sudan, now undergoing a power struggle between its president and former vice president. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lako Tongan.
Thank you very much, Ian, for inviting me.
And you were telling me earlier that your relatives are very concerned about what's happening. You're very concerned about what's happening in the world's newest country that's been at war with the North for some time and now appears to be poised to go to war against itself. Is there a real possibility of a civil war?
This is a tragedy. This is a tragedy for Southern Sudanese. Because, as you have just mentioned, the civil war was fought for about 50 years almost. No real peace existed in South Sudan since 1955, the entire country. And so the achievement of independence was viewed really as the greatest sacrifice that we have made, you know, in order to achieve it, namely the 3 million lives that we lost could be, you know, celebrated for the independence that we achieved. And so witnessing what is going on right now is distressing, not just to South Sudanese alone, but also to our friends who have supported us, actually, in achieving that independence. So what is going on at the moment, I think it's a reflection of many things. And perhaps if you don't mind, let me go through some of them just to highlight what is involved here.
Yeah, please do.
First, I would say that is a power struggle. And that power struggle has been ethnicized, namely that it has taken an ethnic form. And this is tragic because, in a sense, I blame the failure, actually, during the guerrilla war, you know, in educating people as to how to form what you might call, a modern peoplehood, namely uniting the country, actually, or uniting all the people. Second, reasons for the conflict, of course, is the struggle for the control of state power, controlling the state. And as we know, he who that controls the state, especially in Africa, is the one who controls the distribution of state resources. And in the case of South Sudan, this has become more so because of the oil revenues, namely the petrodollars that South Sudan has been able to get. I mean, something like, a billion every quarter, you know, is received from that oil. And so the conflict is how and who can control the state in order to control those revenues that are derived from oil. And in a sense, you could say the politics of South Sudan has become a politics of ethnicizing the modern state, how each ethnic group would like to control the modern state. So what it turns out to be here is that two ethnic groups consider themselves to be numerically more superior than others. The Dinkas are about 2 million, probably 20% of South Sudan population. The Nuers are about 1.5 million, and they are about 15% of the population of 10 million people. That is the estimate that the World Bank and the IMF have estimated. And so what we see here, unfortunately, is that South Sudan does not have classes. We don't have middle class, really. We don't have business class. We don't have classes that can mediate, you know, ethnic interests, mediate ethnic conflicts. And so what you end up really is having elites who are more representing their ethnic groups rather than the national interests of the country, if there is something like that, you know. And so this, in a sense, makes it very difficult to reconcile the contending interests. And so I'm afraid that as long as there are some loose talks, particularly among the elites from the two ethnic groups, they talk about the idea of ruling South Sudan for 1,000 years. I mean, they sound more millenarian, you know, in a sense. And this has been heard a lot, particularly from the Dinka groups. I mean, I've been going home, except last summer. I was there before independence, and then an independence, which in fact I was were planning to talk actually over what was going on. I was planning to talk with you, and then I went the first anniversary, that is 2012, the summer before last. I came back completely discouraged because of the way how the ethnic politics has been heavily, heavily introduced into the politics of South Sudan and how difficult it is for anybody, even for those of us who are outside, you know, to go and participate in administering this country, which needs a lot of at least talents and ideas. But there is an attitude there that if it continues the way it is, especially between the two ethnic groups, South Sudan might go into another civil war, unfortunately.
And my understanding, Lakatongan, is that the president, Salva Kiir, is an ethnic Dinka, but his power struggle is with his former vice president, Riek Machar, who's a newer, and hasn't been some fairly brutal fighting in the very capital, Juba, and then in the town of Bor that the mutineers, newer soldiers, seem to have taken over. So if just from what you've told us, presidents represents the Dinka, who are 20%, and the former vice president represents the newer, who are 15%, who make up the rest of the country?
Exactly. And I think that is the crux, really, of the problem. Namely that if both of them constitute 35%, 65% of South Sudanese are not engaged in what they are fighting over. And that raises the question as to how each of the two is going to try to get support from the remaining 65% of the population. And this is where the danger really lies in terms of civil war. Because both of these groups are located in the northernmost part of South Sudan, namely by the border with Sudan, you know, the old Sudan. And the rest or most of the population that is neither of the two are located more in the southern part of the country. That is what they call the Greater Equatorial, where a lot of southern Sudanese are located. And so it is how these other groups are going to respond to the struggle between the two. And I think what is happening is that Salva Kiir, who represents the Dinka, is trying to recruit or trying to at least bring to his side those non-Dinkas who are located in Greater Equatoria. And the same thing also is happening with Riek Machar. And in fact, if we look at the people who have been arrested or being detained, okay, it goes across the different ethnic groups. It is not just the Nuers who are being detained, but also from other groups like the Bari, the Moro. You know, these are all ethnic groups that are located in southern part of the country, that is in Greater Equatoria. So it seems like Riek Machar has got support, at least from the elites that come from these other groups. And what I think he's able to do is that he's saying, this is not really an attempted coup by the Nuers. But it is, as he has put it, actually, it's not an attempted coup. It is Salva Kiir using it, and I think there is some truth to it, using it in order to purge the party, namely the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, which is the ruling party, purge it of those critics, the critics of Salva Kiir. Because honestly, Salva Kiir is not somebody who is comfortable in dealing with disagreements. He has, I would say, because of the conditions, you know, in the bush, there was little room to deal with the ideas of how to negotiate, you know, when there are conflicts. So he has, to some extent, a military mentality, that it is orders that matters rather than negotiations, you know, to end, let's say, contention or something like that. And I think this is where the tragedy really is. And I think it is, as far as I'm concerned, it is him really who can de-accelerate, you know, the conflict, the crisis at the moment. Because the other groups have come to accept, and this is true, again, that I witnessed when I was there, that Salva Kiir is not listening to other groups. He listens to advisors who tend to come from his immediate, you know, group, from his area. Now, this is not to say that all the Dinkas are united. In fact, it is interesting that there are divisions within the Dinka. So Bor, for example, from which late John Garang came from, is where the Nuers have taken control of. Okay? Secondly, also, the wife of late John Garang, who comes from Bor, has been detained also by Salva Kiir regime. So in a sense, it is more complicated than simply saying it is an ethnic conflict. There are more other, you know, factors that are underlying this. And the most important, of course, is the control of state power, and by extension, the control of the petrol dollars. This is, in a sense, you know, the resource curse that is being manifested in South Sudan.
Well, I'm afraid we're pretty much run out of time, Lakatongan, but it would seem also that you have a terrible ethnic wars going on right next door in the Central African Republic to South
Absolutely.
Sudan. And so the real question would be, you know, is anybody from the outside world going to intervene? The French are intervening along with African troops. But so this is a very volatile mixture, is it not, in this general neighborhood?
Absolutely. And hopefully the UN presence in South Sudan, and just I just look at the news just now, three UN troops have been killed in a place called Akobo, which is on the Ethiopian border. And this is it has been carried out by the Nuers, young Nuers, who have guns, of course. And South Sudan is full of guns. It's full of guns. There is no question about it. And this is the most dangerous thing. Our people take guns to be like a toy, but you know, we
They're a very
never
deadly toy.
Yes.
I agree. Well, look, Laka, let's do a follow-up soon, because it sounds like we certainly need to talk more, and it sounds like things are not improving. I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Laka Tongan, who is a professor of international intercultural studies and political studies at Pitzer College. He was born and raised in what is the world's newest country, South Sudan, now undergoing a power struggle between its president and its former vice president. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the Detroit bankruptcy, where the banks are making out like bandits. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wallace Turberville, who is a senior fellow at Demos, who was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs for 12 years, then a visiting scholar at the Roosevelt Institute, where he authored nearly 30 articles concerning financial reform, energy, and the environment. He then joined Better Markets, Inc., where he proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs and the House Financial Services Committee, and is the author of a new report at Demos, The Detroit Bankruptcy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wallace Turberville.
Happy to be here, Ian.
And Wednesday in Detroit, the federal bankruptcy judge halted the trial and ordered the city to renegotiate this proposed settlement with its creditors. And apparently the judge was disturbed at the imbalance where Detroit's agreed to pay the banks who got them into these complicated swaps, etc. They were about to pay the bank 75 to 82 cents on the dollar, while at the back of the line, they're offering 16 cents on the dollar to the city's pensioners. So that's a pretty outrageous disparity, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I would say so. I had the opportunity to actually be outside the courtroom yesterday in Detroit So I was watching things unfold. In fact, what occurred was the judge has been suggested in court that these payments to the banks, which are secured by some tax revenues of the city, should be subject to equitable subordination, meaning falling back in the line with regular creditors because of various things, including fairness issues, the so-called clean hands doctrine. And the judge has, what the judge said was, please, city, it's really the emergency manager appointed by the governor to take over the city. Tell me what your thoughts are about whether these swap obligations, derivatives obligations, are enforceable. And as it turns out, the agreement they signed with the banks said that the emergency manager would agree not to challenge the swaps in court, which is kind of an interesting outcome. So what happened was that the judge said, I can't really proceed unless somebody can tell me whether these things are fair or unfair, whether equitable subordination might apply or not. And so he said, renegotiate if you want, but unless you can tell me something further, I can't enforce these things.
So how did they get into this situation? And that, of course, is you deal with Wallace Tuberville in your new report at Demos, the Detroit bankruptcy. But for the benefit of our audience, it does seem that when you have a mayor like Kwame Kilpatrick who is running the city and he's now in jail, and it seems to me that the person in the city government that made all of these complicated loan deals with these Wall Street banks, with all these swaps, etc., I understand that he ends up working for the same banks that he made the deal with, and they've paid out $300 million so far and another $300 million in the pipeline. And it seems to me that you can make the case here, surely, that the U.S. attorney should step in here. I mean, is there criminality here?
Well, I can't say. I can't say that you've recited the facts correctly. right now, what I've been advising, and I will be asked to speak to the court as an expert witness, but what I've been advising and talking about is that these things need to be looked at. I can't say, I don't have the facility or the authority to get to the heart of the matter to find out whether it was simply imprudence or whether there was something worse going on or whether there's some secret reason that these things did go on at the time. But I would be satisfied at the outset to just have the court look into it, which is what the court was trying to do, of course. And the court was frustrated because the city in the form of the emergency manager and his advisors would not comment on it because they felt constrained not to do so. It was kind of interesting that the banks sought that as one of the primary things in their contract with the city, not to challenge the validity or authorization of these agreements. So the first step is, of course, just is having somebody look at it, and the bankruptcy court is well situated to do that if it goes forward.
Well, the state-appointed emergency manager, Kevin Orr, was appointed by the governor, of course, who is a Republican. And my understanding is that there is a lot of partisan politics in this. You have a governor in a state that's, you know, rural areas are Republican, urban areas, particularly Detroit, are Democrat. He's a very partisan governor. We've seen him act in very partisan ways. And Kevin Orr is a former corporate bankruptcy lawyer. What can you understand here? You know, we talked about some of the deals that were made that have saddled the Detroit and seem to be the main cause for its bankruptcy. And yet so much of the coverage is about the pension debts that they have. But what about the politics? In other words, should this thing be happening in the first place? If you had a different governor and a different state appointed, well, let's start with a different governor.
Well, I advocated in my report, and of course I'm unconstrained by politics. I can advocate what I think is the appropriate way forward. I advocated in my report that the city really was suffering not from a spending problem. In other words, they had not spent their way through salary and benefits paid to employees into the circumstances they were in. The city was devastated by the Great Recession. The city's been difficult structural problems economically for decades, but when the Great Recession hit, it was really injured badly. The reports say that roughly 73% of the mortgages in the city were subprime, for instance, and the city's unemployment rate shot up to 30%, close to 30%. So the way to move forward would, in my view, would be to have enhanced the city's revenues at least for a short period of time to get it structurally sound from the state, and that would be good for the state and by far the most economical way forward. But that's not the way the state proceeded. They proceeded with this emergency manager law, which took over the city and put them in a position to change the way the city operates over a longer term, from the state down, as opposed from the people of the city of Detroit deciding how to do those things.
So you mentioned how the city of Detroit, you mentioned how that the state could have actually lent the city money, but instead decided to appoint this emergency manager and take it into bankruptcy. And that the reason that the city was suffering was largely because of the recession, the 2008 recession. But weren't all these complicated Wall Street loans that the city took out with these swaps, etc., weren't they done on the eve of the 2008 recession?
Yes, the complicated financings took place, and it was about $1.5 billion worth of financing. What they did was they borrowed that money and actually deposited it into the pension funds to build up the funding in the pension funds. So those complicated financings took place in 2005 and 2006. It wasn't the financings themselves that created the bankruptcy situation. The financings themselves were burdensome, but that wasn't as nearly as important as the fact that the city just lost its revenue base in a catastrophic way. However, once the city got into trouble, what happened is that the complexity of those financings came back to haunt them, because they were on hair triggers those financings were on hair triggers to be terminated, and for the banks to ask for their money all at one time. You know, in essence, they were asking for 25 years of interest on something like $800 million of debt, all to be paid on one day. That's probably the best way to think of it. So that's what happened was, once they got on the ropes and it looked bad for the city in terms of their cash position, the financings then kicked in and the bank started asking for their money immediately. So now the question is, you know, now that since they're in this circumstance, who gets paid? The banks, or the city services get funded, or do the pensioners get paid? So that's what the tension is now, is who gets paid. And the banks and the emergency manager have more or less said that, at least in large measure, it's going to be the banks through these derivatives. And we're saying that now you should resist paying the banks as much as you can and get to the bottom of this. And hopefully that money would then be available for city services and to pay pensioners. Because the pensioners, if they get their benefits cut, it's just going to be a very, very harsh result for them.
Well, at this point, they're being offered 16 cents on the dollar, as opposed to the banks are getting between 75 and 82 cents on the dollar. And these pensions are what they average at about $19,000 a year. and 30,000 for the firefighters who, of course, don't get Social Security.
That's right. So it's $19,000 a year for the on average for the ununiformed, and then police and fire is higher, of course. And these are all very reasonable and modest pensions. So if someone gets cut at that level by half or down to 16%, you're going to have more bankruptcies, of course, and it's going to be the people who had worked for years with the belief that they were putting money away and the city was putting money away for them, so they'd actually have a retirement where they could live and exist, and that's just not going to be the case if the pensions get cut severely at all.
But it does seem that there's some evidence that the banks that sold these swaps may have acted unethically, because in order to pay back this $1.5 billion into the underfunded pensions, the mayor and the city created these nonprofits, did they not, and issued the debt. And then they brought in these interest rate swaps as a hedge, and they basically doubled down. And it's worth reminding our audience that the mayor is in jail. And by the way, is the mayor in jail for taking some kind of kickbacks? Is that, we know that the person who negotiated the loans for the city with the banks ended up working for the banks, right?
Last I checked, he was working for a small bank in Ohio that was part of the deal. The former finance director. Again, I don't know. I mean, what I'm saying is that should be, questioned. I mean, to make certain there was nothing untoward about that. And it is true that the mayor is serving time because of financial dealings with contractors. In fact, he was just recently ordered to pay $4.5 million of restitution to the city. Although I'm sure that's not likely to actually be paid at this point. But that all occurred. I think that the what's most telling is that nobody can answer the question, the following question. let's say you were going to go get a mortgage, you could get a fixed rate mortgage or get a floating rate mortgage. The city did not want interest rate risk exposure. So, but instead of doing just 100% fixed rate debt, they did this large portion of their debt floating rate, and then went through the complex derivative transactions to synthetically create it, convert it to fixed rate. So the simple question is, why didn't you just do it the simple way? And nobody's been able to answer that question. I mean, the emergency manager and his advisors have been asked the question in depositions, and they say, we don't know and we haven't checked. But it stands to reason that oftentimes more complex financings are situations where the financial institutions can charge more money and can make more profit without it being apparent how they're doing it. It's just because they're complex. That simple question has to be answered, and they have to check to see if that's indeed what happened.
But it looks like didn't these casinos, these three casinos, weren't they sort of their $11 million monthly payments were used as collateral?
Well, that's a good question. You actually asked a question that has I've discovered has more legal ramifications than you would think. About 20% of the city's revenues come from taxes on wagering at casinos that are inside the city. And what happened was that not in 2005 when the derivatives were done, but in 2009 there was after the financial meltdown. There was a situation where the banks claimed, again, in 2009, this is 4 years later, we're doing the same thing, but in 2009, the banks claimed that they could terminate and get all their money. In order to avoid the banks doing that, the city entered into an agreement in 2009, which purports to give the banks access for as security, the lien, on these casino revenues. But one of the questions, of course, the court has to determine is whether that was whether that lien will be recognized in bankruptcy, and that's not a completely straightforward answer. And one of the questions that the court was asking over the last couple of days is, does the emergency manager, have you looked into this? What is your advice? Why are you just assuming that that lien was validly granted? And there's been no answer forthcoming today.
Well, of course, the attorneys come for the city come from Kevin Orr's former law firm, and there just doesn't seem to be any real transparency in what in this kind of fire sale or this looting, if indeed that's what it is. But just to finish up here, because we only got a minute left, I asked you earlier about why isn't the U.S. attorney not moving in there? Don't you have a Democratic senator, don't you, there in Michigan?
Yeah, Carl Levin. Yes.
Carl Levin, a very senior guy, and he's one of the people in the Senate that seems to be a champion of the people. So is there any expectation that that's going to be somebody's going to step up here and save this city from this what seems to be an unnecessary bankruptcy?
Well, I from time to time have been in contact with Senator Levin's office about some of these issues. I did a lot of work on the Dodd-Frank Act, financial reform generally. So Senator Levin was a key backer of that. So I am aware of and knowledgeable about his staff. The congressional delegation is watching this. I think they're likely to let the process move on. I think if the court really gets into these circumstances, I think that the bankruptcy court is able to do a lot of work to find out all the circumstances. So I think that's likely what's going to happen. I think that's the first step, and just find out exactly what the actual circumstances were is the first step, and I think the court has shown an interest in doing that, so I think they should proceed.
And that's encouraging, and I thank you very much for joining us, Wallace Turbeville.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Wallace Turbeville, who's a senior fellow at Demos, who was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs for 12 years, then a visiting scholar at the Roosevelt Institute, where he authored nearly 30 articles concerning financial reform, energy, and the environment. He then joined Better Markets, Inc., where he's proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission, Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs and the House Financial Services Committee. And he's the author of the new report at Demos, The Detroit Bankruptcy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and recording engineer Alan Barker. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.